So our subject tonight, brethren and sisters, is entitled Paul Testifies at Caesarea. Let's begin this evening then with a brief recap of the events that we looked at last time, as recorded in Acts 21 through to Acts 23. In our last study, you may recall, we traced Paul's long and difficult journey over land and sea from Corinth to get to Jerusalem. And if you have your handout at home, you'll see on the back of it the map and the table that we studied. And those of you who have a double-sided handout tonight have got that map and that table to look at. And you will remember that we traced his journey, whereby he sometimes stopped along the way, and he took the opportunity when he stopped to see his brothers and sisters. And on one of his stops along the way, he was reduced to tears, you remember, by the anxiety that they showed when he explained his intention to go on to Jerusalem, prompting him to say in Acts 21, verse 13, "What mean ye to weep and to break mine heart? For I am ready not only to be bound, but also to die at Jerusalem for the name of the Lord Jesus." And as we saw last time, that almost happened, didn't it? Just as many of in the ecclesia had expected and warned him, when he eventually arrived there in Jerusalem, his presence provoked a riot among the Jews. And it was only with the help of the Roman soldiers that he escaped with his life. Despite the great danger he was in from those who resented what they thought was a betrayal of Judaism, he'd bravely tried to reason with the mob who would have murdered him if it had not been for the intervention of those soldiers. And then, after avoiding yet another scourging at their hands by pointing out that he was an uncondemned Roman citizen, he had formally to defend himself before the Sanhedrin. And you will, I hope, remember that while conducting his own defence, he realised that the jury was composed of both Sadducees and Pharisees. And knowing the disagreement between them about the resurrection, he thought he saw, didn't he, a way of escape, prompting him to say, "I am a Pharisee, the son of a Pharisee, of the hope and resurrection of the dead, I am called in question." But rather than bringing an end to the trial, it prompted even more arguments and anger among the judges. And so rather than see Paul pulled in pieces by them, as it's recorded, the Roman captain sent his soldiers to extract Paul from this murderous assembly. And after hearing about a plot to kill him, that person, that Roman soldier, sent him under heavy guard down to Caesarea to appear for judgment before the Roman governor Felix. Which brings us to our study tonight and the speeches made by Paul in his defence while he was in Caesarea that are recorded for us in Acts 24, 25 and 26, before he was finally sent to Rome. Now the time chart, the one that looks like that on your handout, the time chart, I hope, illustrates well the main events described in these chapters that we're looking at in this two-part study, and approximately when they took place. As you can see, our study last time and this time covers a period of well over 2 years, during most of which time, 2 years entirely, Paul was in prison. We're now at the point when Paul is in Caesarea, waiting to appear before Procurator Felix, as you see marked against day number 11 along the top there. Day number 11, Paul taken on to Caesarea. As an aside, brethren and sisters, when Felix was first made procurator, he had shared the title with somebody called Cumanus. But Cumanus had been condemned for his maladministration, and so Felix now had total control. Now, this had happened, apparently, about 7 years before Paul was brought before him, which had given him plenty of time to get acquainted with Jewish affairs, and that fact was alluded to, wasn't it, in the reading that Brother Mark just read for us. Felix read the letter from Lysias, and after briefly inquiring to what province Paul belonged, and being told that he was a Cilician, he decided to hear the matter once Paul's accusers had arrived. And meanwhile, for 5 days, he was kept in one of the guard rooms attached to the old Herodian palace, which now formed the splendid residence of the procurators of Judea. So that takes us to day 16 on this chart. Ananias, the high priest, came in person, together with the elders. As Paul had slipped out of their grasp once, they didn't want that to happen a second time, it seems. But because they were unfamiliar with the procedure in Roman courts and little able to plead in Greek or Latin, they engaged the services of a smooth-talking provincial barrister called Tertullus. Now, Tertullus opened the court proceedings with a false compliment to Felix, alluding to his supposed efforts to suppress the bandits and the very recent suppression of the Egyptian false messiah, as well as other reforms, he said, and worthy deeds. Yes, flattery indeed. Whereas the real fact was that Felix was detested by the Jews and had encouraged more brigands than he had removed. Now, apologizing for taking up his valuable time, he stated the three counts upon which Paul was being tried. One, that he was a public pest who lived by exciting factions among the Jews all over the world, so he said. Secondly, that he was a ringleader of the Nazarenes. And thirdly, that he had attempted to profane the temple. This third matter had, said Tertullus, led to his arrest, but Lysias, the Roman captain, had intervened with much violence, he said, criticizing Lysias, and ordered his accusers to come before the procurator. And when called by Felix to answer the charges, Paul opened his defense. We can read about it. I'm sorry, I made a mistake a moment ago. Chapter 24, verse 10. He made a defense by the perfectly true remark that he could defend himself more cheerfully before Felix, knowing that having been a procurator for some considerable time, he must be very familiar with Jewish affairs. Let's just look back at that chapter. Chapter 24, and reading verse 10. Then Paul, after that the governor had beckoned unto him to speak, answered, "Forasmuch as I know that thou hast been of many years a judge unto this nation, I do the more cheerfully answer for myself, because that thou mayest understand that there are yet but 12 days since I went up to Jerusalem for to worship. And they neither found me in the temple disputing with any man, neither raising up the people, neither in the synagogues, nor in the city. Neither can they prove the things whereof they now accuse me. But this I confess unto thee, that after the way which they call heresy, so worship I the God of my fathers, believing all things which are written in the law and in the prophets, and have hope toward God, which they themselves also allow, that there shall be a resurrection of the dead, both of the just and unjust. And herein do I exercise myself to have always a conscience void of offense toward God and toward men." So Paul starts his defense against these unreasonable accusations. He was in Jerusalem, he said, simply to worship, to fulfill his vows. He'd been absent from Jerusalem for many years. He had returned with alms for the poor and with temple offerings. Anyone could have seen him quietly and legally going about his private business in the temple, the matter of the vows. He had discoursed with no one. He had had no occasion, on no occasion attracted any crowd or caused any disturbance, either in the temple or in the synagogues or any part of the city. So he was innocent, he said, of counts 1 and 3. As to why the riot occurred, it had been stirred up by certain Asiatic Jews who ought to have been present with him there in that court of law, and whose absence was proof of the weakness of the case against him. As to the claim made by Tertullus, it's in chapter 24, verse 5, that he was of the sect of the Nazarenes, that was true. But belonging to that sect was not illegal. What's more, he worshipped the God whom, as a Jew, he had always been taught to worship, and he frankly accepted all the Jewish scriptures. He believed, as the majority of the Jews did, in a resurrection of the just and the unjust, as he explained in verse 15. In this faith, it had always been his aim to have a conscience void of offence toward God and towards men. Well, at this point, it must have been quite clear that the case against Paul had, as it were, collapsed, largely due to a lack of substance in the claims against him, lack of witnesses for the prosecution. Well, fortunately, as we see in verse 22, Felix did not simply dismiss the case and, in effect, release Paul into the obvious danger of being murdered by his accusers. He therefore postponed the trial rather than ending it on the grounds of the absence of Lysias as a witness, promising, however, to give a final decision when Lysias came to Caesarea. So Paul was remanded to the guardroom, but Felix gave particular instructions to the centurion that his custody was not to be a severe one, and that his friends were to be permitted to visit him. But as it turned out, brethren and sisters, it was at the whim of this man Felix that Paul languished for over 2 years in that prison, as you see on the time chart, after that period of defending himself and justly proving his innocence. No doubt Felix hoped that Paul would somehow find some money to pay for his release, which would, of course, have gone straight into his pocket. As verse 26 rather clearly indicates, he hoped that money should have been given him of Paul that he might loose him. Meanwhile, he occasionally had Paul come up from the prison and talk to him and tell him about the things that he believed. I think we can imagine how frightening that period of time, that whole 2 years, must have been for Paul, with his life hanging by a thread. But eventually Felix disappears from the political scene. His son, who happened to be named Agrippa, by the way, did not succeed him, and he was actually killed in the eruption of Vesuvius 19 years after these events. Felix himself vanishes into obscurity and indeed into disgrace, and Porcius Festus succeeded him as procurator of Judea in AD 60. So we're now moving to the lower part of this chart, having little detail, none at all, about the 2 years that Paul was in prison. Now, Porcius Festus, or Festus as we'll call him, was a far worthier and more honourable ruler than Felix. He arrived in Palestine about the month of August, and 3 days later left Caesarea for Jerusalem, perhaps to sort out the future of Paul. And as when anyone new comes into office, he got his ear bent by numerous people, all hoping to persuade him to concede to their requests. Let's have a look at what happened. Chapter 25 and verses 2 and 3. Then the high priest and the chief of the Jews informed Festus against Paul, and besought him and desired favour against him, that he would send for him to Jerusalem, laying wait in the way to kill him. So they wanted him to be brought, Paul to be brought, from Caesarea up to Jerusalem, so that they could have a chance to kill him on the way. Well, fortunately, he was a wiser man and could see through that plot. As you can see, the Jews were determined to find illegal ways of doing away with this man if the law was not on their side. Their plan was to set an ambush and finish Paul off once and for all, but Festus was wise enough not to give in to their request and told them to come to Caesarea. And a few days later, he went back there himself and the next day called Paul to appear before him. And this time there was no Tertullus to speak up for the Jews, and it seems that the Jews simply repeated the old charges against Paul from 2 years previous. But they must have added something about Caesar to try and frighten Festus into action, because Paul opens his defence by refuting any offence that he might have made against Caesar. You notice it in chapter 25, and verse 8. While he answered, while Paul answered for himself, neither against the law of the Jews, neither against the temple, and here's the extra bit, nor yet against Caesar have I offended anything at all. Now, very quickly, Festus realized that the dispute was over religious matters, so he suggested to Paul that he could be tried by the Sanhedrin in Jerusalem if he liked. Well, naturally, Paul was against such an idea completely. In fact, that was where all this had started over 2 years before. And in short, the matter seemed to be going round in circles. So perhaps it was in pure frustration, or because he felt he would get more justice out of the Romans, or even out of a wish to get to Rome, that prompted Paul to make his appeal to Caesar. Let's read that. Verse 10. Chapter 25, verse 10. Then said Paul, I stand at Caesar's judgment seat, where I ought to be judged. To the Jews have I done no wrong, as thou very well knowest. For if I be an offender, or have committed anything worthy of death, I refuse not to die. But if there be none of these things whereof these accuse me, no man may deliver me unto them. I appeal unto Caesar. Then Festus, when he had conferred with the council, answered, Hast thou appealed unto Caesar? Unto Caesar shalt thou go. As a Roman citizen, it was Paul's privilege to be judged by Caesar himself. And naturally, Festus was quite happy with the suggestion. At least it would take this troublesome matter out of his hands. Of course, some days would have to go by before Paul could be sent to Rome. A ship had to be found, Perhaps other prisoners had to be tried who might also be referred to the emperor's decision. And as a result of the delay, Paul had a further opportunity to proclaim the truth. When a few days later, King Agrippa, that is Agrippa II apparently, and his sister Bernice came on a visit to see this new procurator in Caesarea. As we read in chapter 25 from verse 13. And after certain days, King Agrippa and Bernice came unto Caesarea to salute Festus. And when they had been there many days, Festus declared Paul's cause unto the king, saying, There is a certain man left in bonds by Felix, about whom I was at Jerusalem, when I was at Jerusalem, the chief priests and the elders of the Jews informed me, desiring to have judgment against him. Well, we can imagine, I think, brethren and sisters, Festus and Agrippa, perhaps chatting over a meal, with Festus mentioning this perplexing case concerning the prisoner Paul. He told him how the Jews had misrepresented the facts surrounding the case, which obviously turned on Mosaic technicalities, and one Jesus who was dead, whom Paul alleged to be alive, he said. These were matters about which Festus had no jurisdiction, and he could not be supposed to know anything, really. The prisoner had refused to be tried again by the Sanhedrin and had appealed to the decision of Caesar. Now, all this must have interested Agrippa, and he asked to see Paul, which Festus duly arranged for the following day, 25, verse 23. And on the morrow, when Agrippa was come, and Bernice, with great pomp, and was entered into the place of hearing, with the chief captains and principal men of the city, at Festus' command, Paul was brought forth. Well, what followed wasn't a trial, brethren and sisters. It was simply a potential source of amusement for two pampered rulers. But Festus laid on all the trimmings, as we can see, we can imagine perhaps, with much pomp and grandeur, which was much to the liking of the Herods, who enjoyed processional display, which fed their vanity. And we're expressly told that Agrippa and Bernice went in state to the praetorium, she doubtless blazing with her jewels, and he in his purple robes, both with the golden circlet of royalty around their foreheads, and eventually seating themselves on golden thrones among these distinguished visitors, the VIPs from the town. And into this intimidating atmosphere came Paul, our brother in Christ, hungry and thirsty, no doubt straight from the prison cell. Festus then opened the proceedings with a short speech, in which he made up an excuse for the gathering. Chapter 25, verse 24. And Festus said, King Agrippa, and all men which are here present with us, ye see this man about whom all the multitude of the Jews have dealt with me, both at Jerusalem and also here, crying that he ought not to live any longer. But when I found that he had committed nothing worthy of death, and that he himself hath appealed to Augustus, I have determined to send him, of whom I have no certain thing to write unto my lord. Wherefore I have brought him forth before you, and specially before thee, O King Agrippa, that after examination had, I might have somewhat to write. For it seemeth to me unreasonable to send a prisoner, and not withal to signify the crimes laid against him. Now we can see that he relayed how infuriated the Jews had been at Paul, but that as far as he could see, Paul was innocent of a capital crime. But having appealed to Caesar, it was now up to Festus to send him for judgment. But he didn't want to send him, as it were, empty-handed, without a letter to Caesar himself. Now, a lesser man than Paul might have despised that proceedings, perhaps even made some remark to that effect. But Paul didn't. From somewhere he found the energy and the willpower to grasp yet another chance to preach the truth. Nothing in the speech suggests that Paul was anything but totally in control of that situation. Surely the Spirit was with him and gave him at that vital moment such words as he needed to speak. And so Paul opened yet again, as he did before Felix, with a sincere compliment, this time to King Agrippa. Unlike the mock sincerity that Tertullus had displayed to Felix 2 years previously. He was happy, he said, to answer for what he believed before Agrippa, because Agrippa himself was a Jew, and Paul knew that Agrippa's father had trained him well in Jewish matters, which made him a competent judge. Chapter 26, verse 2. I think myself happy, King Agrippa, because I shall answer for myself this day before thee, touching all the things wherever I am accused of the Jews, especially because I know thee to be an expert in all customs and questions which are among the Jews. Wherefore I beseech thee to hear me patiently. Now Josephus tells us that Agrippa was a mild-mannered man, and he didn't have the extreme views of Paul's Jewish accusers, or the despotic tendencies of many of his fellow rulers of the time. And so Paul simply asked for a patient audience to what he had to say. And once more, as we read in Acts 26, verses 9 through to 23, that familiar story was patiently told all over again, about his earlier life persecuting the church, followed by his conversion on the Damascus Road by a vision of his resurrected Lord, and since when he had simply been acting on his convictions and obeying the commands given to him to preach the truth to anyone who would listen. He was in full flood when he was interrupted by Agrippa, at the point at which Paul was telling him about Christ's resurrection and the forgiveness of sins that was possible through him, Agrippa couldn't take any more. He suddenly burst out with a loud and excited interruption. You are mad, Paul. These many writings are turning your brain, making you mad. But Paul wasn't ruffled by that statement. Calmly and respectfully, he responded that he was not mad. Deadly serious, that's all. After all, surely the king had heard something about all this before, because it was headline news, and news still travelled around in those days. And then Paul asked a very bold question. King Agrippa, dost thou believe the prophets? I know that thou believest. But Agrippa was too proud, wasn't he, to answer that question publicly. And like every politician all down the ages, he avoided a direct answer with a wry smile, no doubt, and good-natured contempt of Paul's enthusiastic earnestness, which would even for a moment fancy that he, King Herod Agrippa, would be converted to the heresy of the Nazarenes with their crucified Messiah. It was impossible not to admire Paul's burning zeal, was it, brethren and sisters, which neither stripes nor prisons could quench, and the clear-sighted faith which not even such intimidating surroundings could dim for one moment. Paul's speech was so logical, so sincere, delivered so eloquently, that Agrippa's reaction to it is hardly surprising, is it? You're almost persuading me to be a Christian. Paul's final words on the matter are exemplary, aren't they, brethren and sisters? There's so much for us to learn from Paul's handling of this very difficult situation. In some ways, they characterize the purpose of his whole life. He said, I could pray to God that not only thou, but even all those who are listening to me today might become even such as I am. Except these bonds. I wonder, brethren and sisters, if there were some listening that day who were sufficiently moved by Paul's oration to look into the truth further, perhaps even to be baptized. Perhaps so. If there's a particular lesson to be learnt from these events, it has to be that final comment, I think, by Agrippa. Paul had almost persuaded him to be a Christian, but Agrippa had just stopped short of that commitment. And since then, how many more people have done just the same thing? Either because they're not willing to give up their unchristian way of life, or because they fear the consequences of being a Christian, or because their pride prevents them from being baptized. And so they put off the decision, perhaps with the excuse that they will wait for a more convenient time. Well, unfortunately, like Agrippa, the outcome must be that they remain strangers from the covenants of promise. So what was the outcome of these days' events? Indeed, over 2 years of hard trial for Paul. Surely it was a letter to Nero expressing the innocence of Paul, who neither Felix, Lysias, Festus, nor Agrippa, nor even the Sanhedrin had been able to convict on any charge at all. But it was in God's purpose that his servant Paul should go to Rome as a witness to the truth there, and to which city Paul began his perilous journey a short time after our account ends. Well, brethren and sisters, I wonder if Paul knew much about the man who would next be his judge. Nero. While all this had been going on in Jerusalem and Caesarea, Nero had been busy plotting the death of his own mother, historians tell us. The story of her death and Nero's part in it are wild, they're fantastical, you might say. They involve poison, booby-trapped falling ceilings, and lead-lined ships designed to sink and so make her death look like an accident. Well, whatever the real truth is, it does seem that Nero was heavily involved in her death in March AD 59. And not surprisingly, he came to be haunted by it, apparently hearing voices and trumpets in distant hills. And so Paul was soon to set out on a very perilous journey that would bring him into the power of a very cruel, a murderous, and a haunted man. Perhaps in God's mercy, such a fact was currently hidden from Paul as he left Caesarea, bound for Rome. As a final thought, brethren and sisters, it's surely one thing to stand and be heckled on a street corner. Perhaps some of us have had that experience. Not a nice experience, but survivable. But when some while ago I stood in the Roman arena in Verona and later beside the Colosseum in Rome and thought about what went on there in the first century, I couldn't help thinking that it's quite another matter to stand up for what you believe when your very life is in the hands of those who could dispose of you with a moment's gesture of their thumb, as they did for so many faithful brethren and sisters 2,000 years ago. Well, Paul had already spent several years not knowing whether each day that dawned was to be his last, and more time in a Roman prison still awaited him, as we well know. And during that time, the final words of Agrippa to Festus must have been echoing in his head and making him wonder if he had made the right decision about coming to Rome. What were those words? This man might have been set at liberty if he had not appealed unto Caesar. But his faith never faltered, as we can see from the conviction in the speeches that he made and the letters that he wrote for our benefit. What a truly wonderful example to believers of all ages of what it really means to be a Christian. And one day soon, the liberty that was denied Paul almost 2,000 years ago will be granted to him. Not to be released into a world full of vice, violence, injustice, but into a new creation, to receive that crown of righteousness laid up ready for Paul and for all those who will appear before the just and merciful King sitting on David's throne in Jerusalem. May that long promised day soon come.